The Guardian.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen, sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar.
Hello. Over the two decades since his Melrose saga began, Edward St. Aubyn has emerged as one of the most brilliant stylists in contemporary fiction. The five books tell the painfully autobiographical story of Patrick Melrose, the abused son of an aristocratic family. Mother's Milk, the subject of this month's book club, is the fourth volume in that saga. It finds Patrick in adulthood, transferring his gaze from his appalling, now dead, father to his mother. So why, John Mullen started out by asking, did it open with a five-year-old boy imagining himself being born?
Well, there's no claim that this is his voice.
No. I mean,
that would be completely unbelievable. But it's his point of view narrated for him in the best way that I was able to narrate it. So there are four points of view in the novel, but not four voices. I think also Robert is... This book in general is about the presence of the past in people's lives, and Robert is already in a state of nostalgia, although he's only five. The presence of an infant makes him start to be aware of what he's lost.
I noticed, as you know, reading 130 odd novels for the Booker Prize the year I judged it, you really notice everybody who does that feels obliged not to do what you do, but to try to replicate. You know, it's a kind of, I don't know, it's a kind of creative writing itch almost, to try to replicate what it's like to see and speak and think like a child. But you give us the child, but filtered through this incredibly sort of, I suppose, sophisticated and sort of rich vocabulary of narrative.
Yes, I think it also gives unity to the whole book, to have a consistent narrator. The narrative tends towards the concerns of each of the characters and therefore changes its vocabulary a little bit, but it remains a consistent narrative with a shifting point of view. I don't want to stray into the territory of another book, but I think with At Last there's a different kind of method and there's much more a sense of the narration passing from character to character. And each mentality taking over the storytelling in turn. But here we have a stable narration from different points of view.
And it's funny because I assume, partly because I've read some of the other books, that Patrick is sort of the central character. But in Mother's Milk, we don't actually in a way get to him. I mean, we hear him. But we hear it all in a way through the child, and we don't sort of get to Robert till quite a long way through the novel. Quite a long way through the novel.
Yes, Patrick has the second section. You know, if I'd been writing a memoir, I would have stayed with Patrick's point of view throughout. That would have been the right thing to do. But I think the strength of a novel is to be able to present multiple points of view. And so in this case, I'm interested in the dramatic truth of something that's happening to Patrick and to all the other people involved. And so I wanted to have a sort of arena of points of view on the situation. Patrick's is only one of them.
And when we're listening, when the child sort of listens to them, they're amazing. I have seen on occasion one person, a critic, complaining about the fact that Patrick and his wife in particular are very articulate and their conversations, their dialogue. And in a way, not surprised that Robert should become quite sort of good with words because they are very good with words.
I think some people do become more articulate as they get angrier. Apparently that's what happened to Henry James. His writing was quite complicated. His normal speech was even more complicated. But if he got angry, the subclauses stretched on several hundred pages and people were terrified. But I mean, I'd rather have characters who were talking about the themes of the book intelligently than not. You know? So I don't want to apologize for my characters making sense. It's true that in so-called real life, you know, often people aren't as clear as the characters in the novel. But is that what novels should be doing, just creating a sense of verisimilitude and, you know, having everyone hesitate and repeat themselves?
Well, of course
they boring,
no,
you know?
Well, they
of course
don't,
not.
Because all know. And the novelists who claim...
I don't ever read my reviews. I mean, thanks for telling me about these, these complaining critics. I thought there weren't any. You know. anyway, never mind.
He seems to be sort of... he actually says to that friend Johnny, the child psychologist, he actually says, doesn't he, he's terrified of wordlessness. Mm. That's his sort of... You know, that's his fear, which does seem a kind of paradoxical thing for somebody who, even when he's drunk, which he quite often is in the book,
yes,
is very, seems very good with words.
He's using words, he's deploying words the whole time to deal with this sense of fragmentation and extreme emotion. But wordlessness is one of the great themes of this book, and he's in the presence of an infant son who can't yet speak, and of a mother who can no longer speak, and so he's very acutely aware of people who are having experience without language, and then he's throwing all the language he can get at the experience that he's having. And I think in At Last, this theme of sort of inarticulacy becomes interiorized. It's Patrick's sense of his own helplessness and his connection with his own infancy. Because after all, we've all had, everyone in this room has had the experience of being without language and helpless and without words. And, you know, certain times in life, like having a newborn child or feeling especially vulnerable, takes us back to that.
One of the consequences of the dialogue that Mary and Patrick have is kind of, it's this funny thing that sort of, in a way, it looks, in a conventional novel, it would might look as if they were sort of breaking apart because she's retreated off with the baby. Mm. They don't have sex anymore. He's much preoccupied with this. One of the effects of that was to sort of, on the reader... on this reader, on me, was to make me start rather desperately hoping they'd get together again when I was reading this book, which, of course, in this book, they sort of don't, because they seem just sort of, in terms of dialogue, kind of the people who are best suited to each other, if you see what I mean.
I think that's right, but you understand why they were together in the first
yes.
place.
Yes, and you give the third part of the book to Mary.
For balance, that was, and obviously that was more challenging for me. Patrick is an alter ego, I'm just going to admit that. And narrating a sort of mother's point of view was a challenge. It was done from observation rather than from introspection.
It seems necessary as a way of showing that she knows certain things. There are all sorts of things she doesn't tell people that she knows. Simple things like she knows he's having this affair.
Yes.
She seems to know when he's lying and when he's not, you know. She knows the patterns of how, you know, he gets drunk and then he's even worse when he gives up the booze.
But I think also she's a character of real strength.
Yes.
She's quite dignified and sort of doesn't need to argue with him about it. But she's caught in her compulsive self-sacrifice. Everyone is in their own trap. You know, Eleanor is a compulsive philanthropist.
There are quite a lot in the dialogue in the novel. There are quite a lot of riposte, I suppose I'd call them. Patrick and Mary and Robert, as he gets a bit older, are very good at riposte, you know, things which are not, quite often, especially with Mary, I think the person speaking to them doesn't necessarily understand that they've just been kind of wounded with an épée. Or
Mary does make one or two sharp or funny remarks, but she's not as obsessively aphoristic as Patrick is. You know, but she can hold her own.
He specialises in ones that, in a way that the other person's not going to understand. The Margaret, the awful nanny, is telling Thomas what his reflection is.
Yes, yes.
In a mirror. And I think he knows that he's in his body rather than stuck to a piece of glass, said Robert's father. He hasn't read Lacan's essay on the mirror stage yet. That's when the real confusion sets in.
Yes, he does know that Margaret hasn't read it either.
But it seems to kind of catch him, really. That
he does do that quite a number of times with Margaret, but not particularly with the other characters.
He is a barrister.
I suppose Patrick's a barrister, to show that unlike his parents, he had to earn his own living, and I suppose to show that he did that by being persuasive with words and by being concerned about justice. So it seemed to fit in with some aspects of his situation. But I mean, there aren't any courtroom scenes, I admit.
Although his son seems to have taken on some of his sort of argumentative abilities or his rhetorical skills.
Yes. Well, children do imitate their parents.
Is it important to know about what has kind of happened before this novel starts to him?
I don't think so at all. There's no backward reference to Some Hope. Mother's Milk is entirely freestanding. It's in at last that you have a convergence of the two streams from Some Hope and Mother's Milk, and some kind of resolution. And in fact, I wrote Mother's Milk originally. Can you imagine? It was going to be a monologue from the maternity nurse's point of view, written in the first person. I got to page 60. I've lost those pages. It's a tragedy. But but I realised it was too restricted.
What, the maternity nurse at Thomas's birth?
The maternity, Margaret.
That would have been.
I wrote 60 pages.
She would have been one of the great monstrous narrators
in the first person, and then I decided to just have her as one of the third person characters. And originally it wasn't written as a Melrose book. I thought I'd finished with the Melroses with Some Hope, and I, in fact, the protagonist was called Mark instead of being called Patrick. And then when I realised that I'd just created a copy of The Melrose World and that it was a Melrose book, I had to change Mark to Patrick. But I didn't know how to do it on my change all function. And so I ended up with a novel which had people going to the Super Patrickette and having puncher Patricks in their arm. And it was a disaster. It took me about a month. It was a difficult birth. That's how it turned into a Melrose novel. And in writing a novel, there's always some kind of mixture of intention and inspiration, or of planning and the unconscious. In my case, with these last two books, the proportions of the part over which I have no control, the inspiration or the unconscious, have been very high.
But also it's got this sort of neat, really, structure, which is very noticeable. That's in four sections, and it's August 2000, August 2001, August 2002, August 2003, four sort of summer holidays. Why did you want to do it like that?
I think I've always been very interested in the unities, you know, unity of time and place and so forth. In the case of Some Hope, each novel is set on one day in one place. And in the case of At Last, it's set over 5 hours in London. So in a way, this was my most diffuse novel. But nevertheless, I wanted to have a strong and simple structure. And I think that's because I feel that I'm dealing with very explosive emotional material and that I need a very simple container for it. It's when the loss of the house is felt most acutely by the family. And but I think in this case I didn't want to set it over one day because I needed that progress, the gradual decay of Eleanor, the gradual certainty that the house is going to be lost, and the gradual darkening towards the assisted suicide, which Eleanor ultimately refuses.
And this is part of a kind of drama of parenthood that. It's so much a novel about whether one set of parents can kind of liberate themselves from their own parents.
Yes, I think both Mary and Patrick, although they have their difficulties, are very consciously involved in this project of interrupting various destructive patterns that have run through their family of disinheritance or of neglect or of cruelty or whatever it may be, and making a fresh start. And they're imperfect, but they're working hard at that.
It's got, I'm sure, past the stage when I should give others a chance.
I have to say I enjoyed your book very much, so thank you. The comedy seems to be what carries the book very often. You make Patrick, who, if I'm shorthand and call him the hero, a very, very flawed character.
There's a kind of democracy of entrapment, that everyone is in their personality, trapped in their personality, and that it's a kind of hell because it's a trap, not because it's one kind of personality rather than another, but because they don't have any freedom. The overarching theme of all these books is about whether we can have a voluntary life and whether there can be any freedom. And there are some characters who are reveling in their lack of freedom, and there are some who are very consciously pursuing it, like principally Patrick, but also Mary and Johnny and other characters. It's comic rather than condescending, and it's from the point of view of everyone being in this trap of being themselves.
I just wanted to ask a bit more about your writing process, and do you work regularly or not at all, and what do you have difficulty, if you have any at all, with writing?
I have nothing but difficulty, and once I've started a novel, I try and work 7 days a week, because if I stop, it becomes harder to go on almost instantly, and if I stop for several days, I can't remember how to write at all. So I have to keep going. I write from very early in the morning, maybe 3, 4, 5, it depends, into the middle of the morning or up till lunchtime, and I write longhand, because I prefer to work things out on a page with a pen. I can do marginalia, I can see the history of all the things I crossed out and corrected, I can do circles and arrows and things that I can't do on a computer. Then I transcribe, print out, correct, transcribe, print out, correct. Probably somewhere between 10 and 30 times for each page. And then that's the first draft. The advantage of that is the first draft is very close to what gets printed. So there isn't much editing at the end. That's because I can't bear to go on knowing that something's wrong, so I at least think it's okay by the time I've finished. And yes, everything is very difficult. I think I write quite badly to begin with, and I just rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. Only occasionally the things that go well are that sometimes writing dialogue is like eavesdropping, and I get a whole page, quite easily. And sometimes I burst out laughing. That happens about 3 or 4 times. and so that's really enjoyable. And the other pleasure is that I'm surprised by something, that I realize that I couldn't have had a thought without being in the process of writing a novel. And so I've got out of my own habitual thinking. I've seen something I didn't know I knew. Those are the three pleasures. The rest is just pure hell.
Do you allow? Are you allowed to allow any editing by your publisher at all? Or is it delivered and you are able to insist, or it gets published as you would like?
I imagine
that might be difficult.
I don't insist, but it doesn't. There aren't big changes. They don't sort of say, I think Patrick should be a woman, or, I think, the third chapter should be the eighth chapter or something like that. So it tends to be, but editors do come up with very good detail at the sort of sentence level and polishing things when I think they're polished and I'm wrong. They do see things, absolutely. not a ton of things because I'm such a control freak, but they do see things, and I'm very grateful for that. Between my agents and the publishers, they add an extra level.
Just wondering if you have the experience of rewriting and things getting worse with when you add your extra control to the writing itself, that whether you ever get to the point where you feel you've completely lost what you were doing in the first place or what you had.
Absolutely, and that's when you stop. I mean, that's the only time I know that I should stop, is when I'm disimproving the sentence. I can see, you know, that it's getting better and better, and then it's getting worse and worse. So I go back to whatever the peak was, and I use that sentence. I mean, the question is, you know, why do you stop rewriting in a way? When do you know that it's right, and when does it click? And I can't answer that. I mean, that's just down to taste. It's something very deep. You feel that the sentence is right. There are kind of literary critical things you can say, that you want to change the rhythm from the last sentence, or you want to move from a sort of introspective passage to a comic passage, or from description to dialogue and so forth. But that doesn't really explain why the sentence clicks, why it seems right as it is and falls into place. And that's just down to something inside everybody that is their own taste. And I think that's probably what a writer has to become confident about. And it's still very difficult, but then at least you know it's settled when you've done it.
I was just wondering about your literary influences, the authors that have influenced you and inspired you, or do you see your novels as sui generis?
I think the point of a writer is to be unlike any other writer. Of course, I became a writer because I was an avid reader. I was influenced by people who are so obvious it's not worth mentioning almost. I mean, just by the great writers, you know, by Joyce, by Proust, by Beckett, Nabokov, Henry James. You know, I read English literature at Oxford, so I sort of drank in all these influences. And then since I started writing, I've been reading much less fiction. I've rather starved myself of fiction. And you might say that there's an element of anxiety, of influence. But I also think it's because I was very, very open and receptive and permeable at a certain age. And I think that I'm less so now, you know, but between, say, mid-adolescence and 25 or 28, I was taken over by the books that I read. Now, if I read a book, I just look at how it's done and whether there's anything I can learn from it. You know, I see it with a very technical gaze. So I don't think I go on being influenced probably now.
Is that a loss, do you think?
Yeah, sure. But it's also, again, I'm also writing. You know, I couldn't have written when I was someone who was taken over by each author that I read. You know, For me, it's very much a question of, you know, I wanted to be well read, now I want to be well written, you know, and that there's that for me they seem to be incompatible projects to a certain extent. So I don't read a lot of contemporary fiction or new fiction, but between novels, I often reread. Between Mother's Milk and At Last, I reread all of Tolstoy, Turgenev. I reread great books that I've read before, and it's a bit limited. I mean, but I don't really want to keep up with the contemporary scene.
You know, given that it is a roman fleuve, do you find it difficult to start at the beginning and then end at the end with the trilogy? You know, do you know exactly where you're going before you start?
No, I didn't. I did with the trilogy. I thought the trilogy was it, that I was, and I had a very clear vision that it was in three parts. It was going to be the crisis, the consequences of the crisis, and the resolution of the crisis. It was much more planned and clear. And then I stumbled back into the Melroses with Mother's Milk, and then closed with with at last. But at every point after the trilogy, I've been confused about what I'm doing. But now it's over, so I say. But I do feel very unemployed. You know, I have been living with these characters. It is 22 years from the writing the first sentence of Nevermind to writing the last sentence of At Last. And I wrote two non-Melrose novels as well, but I've lived with these characters for a long time. So I'm sad.
Yeah, because there's that thing, I don't know if you know, but you say you don't ever read reviews or anything, but David Sexton, who is Mr. Stern critic, I can tell you, and he said the sequence was one of the great achievements of British fiction of the last 50 years. And I thought, God, it'd be lovely to have that said about you. But then I thought, that sounds like quite a sort of...
an epitaph. Yeah. Well, there you are. Well, either I will find new territory or I'll have a prequel. What were the Melroses doing in the 18th century?
Yeah.
You're longing to know. Don't pretend. Yeah.
Is there any more questions before we give Edward a chance to taste the Guardian Chardonnay?
Thank you very much.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen is sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar. Cornish cheddars made with over 60 years of knowledge, time, and skill. To find out more, please visit davidstowecheddar.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.